Today we're talking to Mike Schuler, and he's a fascinating chap. We've already talked to him about the TMS, but I understand he's been doing some amazing projects all around the world. What did you say were your favorite projects?
Oh, I don't know. It's a good thought. It's something to think about, because certainly I've had wonderful opportunities to get involved in projects at really exotic location. I worked on Easter Island, putting in a monitoring system, not on the big heads, but at one of their ceremonial sites, of tracking movement of 30 boulders that had petroglyphs carved on them. I worked for That was for the World Monuments Fund, also for the World Monuments Fund in Cambodia. Worked there for 9 years on the Temple of Angkor Wat, Phnom Penh, Pra Khan, Ta Som, four different temples. So those were wonderful, but I don't know. I think some of my favorite projects are ones that they're just fun, I'm a mountain guy. I live out in Colorado. I grew up in Colorado, and I love doing mountain stuff. And so not that long ago, maybe 5 years ago, we were part of a team working on designing and rebuilding the Sperry Chalet, which is in Glacier National Park, built in the before 1920, I want to say like 1917, by the railroads as a destination. So the railroads would take people up the valley, then they'd get on horses or they'd hike up to these chalets. There's a whole series of them, and they'd walk from one to the next over time. And Sperry Chalet was 6.5 miles in, 3,000 feet up in the middle of Glacier National Park. And we had to carry bear spray, and there's grizzly bears all over, and you don't go out alone. If you're walking up the trail, you're instructed to always, keep talking, or you sing, or you go around the corner. You don't ever do it blind. If you can't see around the corner of the trail, like, "Hey bear, what's going on, bear?" Because you don't want to jump up a grizzly. But so that was great fun. I got to go and visit that site 3 times while we were evaluating it the first time, and all my radar gear and testing gear was brought up on mules.
Oh my
Yeah,
goodness.
big goat train. I know. It was so fun. And then the second time, and we hiked in, and it's a heck of a hike, and you get up there, and the contractor to put up a bunch of platform tents. So we're sleeping in tents with the architects and engineers and all this. It was really fun. And then hiked up the second time. The third time, I had my backpack ready in the morning. We're going to hike up. And the contractor says, "Well, Mike, we got an extra seat on the helicopter. You want to fly in?" It's like,
Yes,
"Oh,
of course.
yeah." Yeah. And it was great because, it was a challenging project too, because it had burned in a forest fire.
Oh, wow.
And, the masonry was still standing. Nothing wood was left, of course. But the big question I think I was tasked with was understanding, what happened to the stone and the mortar, and there were some concrete lintels. What happened to them due to these high temperatures and experience during the fire, and how do we deal with that and fix it? And turns out that, we know pretty well how high temperatures affect concrete. But looking, we never knew it. Nobody's done much work on how it affects mortar. So I've actually had Namratha in my office, and Dave did a little study on. We've got a
Well done.
2,000 degree oven in our lab. And so just looking at, what does 200 degree temperature do to mortar strength? What is 400 and 600? So we got a nice little publication out on that.
But that's one thing that people don't know about you is that you have a really good lab. Then you've done
Oh, it's a,
all kinds of testing and
yeah, it's a fun little lab.
it
It's
really is.
honestly, it's a two-car garage. We convert it to a lab, and we do a lot of fun things. We do a lot of chemical testing and mortar. We don't do a lot of commercial work, honestly. It's just in support of our projects, or we do research, a lot of injection grout development, some anchor testing.
I came up and did some anchor
That's
testing.
right.
Yes,
That
thank
was
you.
pretty
That was
fun.
fun. That was fun. I went up to Mike's labs and we tested the wall tie system and some different systems to see how they work and things. And it was absolutely amazing. We got to spend some time with Mike up at his offices and around. It's a beautiful place.
Oh, and we got Alan out on the river. I was teaching him some fly fishing. That was
Yes.
great fun. Until
Oh, sure.
I know I'm fishing. I was actually catching a couple fish
Yes.
downstream for you.
Yes.
And he's like, "Oi, Moink! Moink! And I look around, Alan's shoe is floating down the river next to me. Ooh. It's like,
got stuck in the bottom, did it?
Yeah, it got stuck in some mud, and I couldn't, it was a pretty fast flowing river, and I couldn't chase that, so it's down river.
But hold on, one of the things that Mike did was said, have you done much fly fishing? I said, no. So he said, I'm going to teach you. So we stood in a car park with a headwind blowing, and Mike said, watch this. This is how you do it. And he taught me how to fly fish in a car park before we went on the river with a headwind. And it was amazing.
You stand on the side of the highway and you teach. Well, that's how I learned to fly fish. I had an old guy, Joe McCarthy. I worked the first year I was in college. I remember I quit my job at the time thinking, oh, college, engineering school. I got a counselor around that. And about 2 months in, I was kind of bored. So I started working at a sporting goods store and, you know, and camping, hunting department, photography, and fishing.
Wow.
And the old guy there, Joe McCarthy, he was a fly fishing guide, and he was like 70 something at the time. So we'd go out in the alley behind the store, and he taught me how to fly cast.
Oh, you taught me a lot, Mike. And as you said, we've been fishing down here. We fished down in San Padre when we give a presentation. We've been fishing across at the lake here. It's a common ground with us and riding bikes, isn't it? And, that's what keeps us going. But to get back to you, anyway, enough about all that. Get back to your labs.
No, but it's important to think about. I mean, if me anymore, you know, I'm not rich by any means. We've got to pay the bills, but the projects that are interesting to me are the ones that, you know, that are fun and a good challenge, you know. And Sperry Chalet was great fun because I got to hike into it. And I've got a similar one now in Southern Colorado. This is the third summer the contractor's working on it. It's an old railroad grade that 100 feet on each side of the railroad is a historic district for like 10 miles. It was the first railroad to come into this Western Colorado Valley, and the very first railroad tunnel under the Continental Divide, which is, you know, the highest that separates the Atlantic Ocean from the Pacific Ocean, all the watersheds. And it's like from the 1877. Woo. And part of this historic road is absolutely fascinating. They had stonemasons from, guess where, Al?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The UK, from Wales and all
Blighty,
that.
I'll say it, mate. Blighty, mate. Blighty, isn't it?
They had stonemasons, and they built a whole series of retaining walls. Because you imagine this railroad going up above tree line, you know, came through this tunnel at almost 12,000 feet of elevation.
Wow.
And we're working on part of a wall called the Palisade Wall, which was, they put this railroad along a cliff, like a cliff. They just cut into this cliff, and then they built this big stone wall, 35 feet tall.
Wow.
Holding up the railroad grade. Oh. 35 feet is, you know, you think about, oh yeah, 35 feet, whatever, but you get down the base of this wall and you look up, and it's super impressive.
I mean, what keystones were they using?
No, the stones were massive. They're like 3 feet by 1 foot by, you know, 2 feet deep.
Yes.
And they're just granite, no mortar.
Wow.
All dry stack.
Wow.
And so it was holding up the wall, and it did great. The railroad's long since abandoned, and the rails and the ties were taken out in the 50s. So it's just a Jeep road now. But I want to say maybe 2015, there was, I don't know, in the spring, section of this wall had collapsed. They say, oh, it was an avalanche, and probably was, or probably it was something related to water, just, you know, saturating all the earth behind this wall. And so we got the contract to design the repairs. So we got to go up there. I got to take my Jeep up. And
you are happy out. Now. I love his Jeep.
And you either, yeah.
He loves his Jeep.
I love the Jeep, yeah. So all these things, and brought my fly rod, and, you know, evaluating this wall is just up there by myself. And I could either drive for 45 minutes each way to get to the closest town where I could stay, or I just brought my tent. And so I'd stop working about 5 or 6 and go out and fish a little and make dinner. And
isn't that a dream? Isn't that what a dream is about?
Yeah. But it's a fascinating project, because we've got a stonemason that is just right for the job. They like doing these big stone jobs. And last summer, they spent the whole summer cutting stone, getting stone ready to rebuild.
Right.
So the Forest Service, you know, is allowing them to take rock off the mountainside, just like they did originally. There's like a big, I mean, it must be a 200 acre, you know, rockfall area. Yes. So they're pulling rocks down. They're splitting them with feathers and wedges.
Oh, wow. The old
you ever do that?
Yeah. An old mason taught me that in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're splitting these stones and making these big stones, and they stockpile them. And it's funny. I just got a note that we've got to schedule our kickoff meeting for this summer, and they can't, you usually can't get up there till around July 1st because there's so much snow.
Is that how long it takes it to melt?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and then the season's done in September because it starts snowing like hard.
So, I mean,
so they got like a 3 month max season, you know? You got all of July, August, and some of September.
Is it 7 days a week that they just go out here?
They were doing six.
Yeah, but it's a tough one because they haven't to go from morning to night, right?
I think actually what they were doing long days. And I think they were doing like, I think they were doing 10 or 12 hour days Monday through Thursday. Yeah. Then Friday they'd do half a day or something, and they go home to see their family.
Right.
And then Sunday they drive back because most of these guys were from, you know, about 2 or 3 hour drive away.
Sounds a good project, but I've always wanted to ask you this though. I've been seeing you on TV one time on National Geographic explaining to somebody. I was talking to somebody.
Oh yeah. That was fun.
I was talking to a friend of mine about Michael Schuller, and I was sat watching TV, and on it was National
History Channel. History Channel. Yeah.
And I was saying to my friend, I said, Michael Schuller. And I said, well, where is he? I said, you won't believe it if I told you. He's on the bloody TV. In front of me.
Just by chance?
Just by chance. But I was explaining about the different buildings that he works on and structures. Guess what he was stood in front of?
Can't imagine.
The Taj Mahal.
The Taj Mahal.
How the heck did you get on the Taj Mahal?
Well, that was great. You know, I mentioned the World Monuments Fund, Easter Island, Angkor Wat and all. And a British producer had called them up, said, we need somebody that knows something about old buildings. And they try this guy. And it turned out, I actually did three shows for the History Channel in 2007. One on the Taj Mahal and two in Russia. And so it was kind of fun. It was kind of stupid, you know, but it suited me well. I got to play the idiot investigator. So you go to the Taj Mahal. And they had like two hosts of the show. There's an architect woman and I was the engineering side. So we'd pull out the guy from the Indian Archaeological Society. And we'd be standing in front on the backside of the Taj Mahal. And it's like, and I'd have to say, well, I can't imagine. How did they build this? You know, and what kind of foundation did they use? Knowing I know exactly how they built it. But, you know, that was my role. And so he would talk about all this stuff. But I tell you, one of the high points, maybe the high point of my career was we were at an area where they were touching up some of the marble inlay, you know, because the Taj Mahal has all these semi-precious stones inlaid in these floral patterns and all. And I got up on the scaffold and I'm watching the guy and he's buttering the back of this piece with their special mortar and press them in. And I'm like, and he didn't talk English. I didn't talk any Hindi, of course. And so he's getting the next one ready. I'm like, give it. And I started to grab it. And he's like, no, I'm not letting this guy touch it. Like, hey, give me this piece. And so I got to put two pieces of inlay in the Taj Mahal.
Oh, yeah. Oh my goodness. That is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was pretty
sweet. How many people are ever going to say it?
No.
No, thank you.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good experience. It was kind of funny because it was, you know, these reality TV shows. They're all kind of contrived. Uh-huh. You know, you have to kind of make it dramatic and like, how did they ever do this, you know?
But on the flip side, Mike's one of them. He'll always help people as best he can. And he's always there and supportive. And when I asked him if he'd come and do a workshop in University of Brownsville, Texas, he jumped to it. And that's going to be another story down the line. But there's a lot.
There was fishing involved. That's how you got it.
There was fishing and laughing
and a little a long weekend on South Padre Island. So wait, I will talk about that some other day.
Yeah, we will do.
Oh my gosh, there were funny stories.
It was a funny story. But to get back to you, Mike, one of the things is as well is that not when you're traveling around the world, which you've got a lot of experience, you've been involved in lots of projects in America of historical nature. that really, really need an outside look of forensics,
right?
Slash, don't run, let's walk. And take your time a little bit because what is it? They like the old one: measure twice, fix once. You know,
yeah. Measure twice, cut once. That's right. That's a good one.
And I think that that's what you bring to the table. But what you also bring to the table is a lot of information with new tech, like ground penetrating radar, flapjack testing, water testing.
Yeah.
And things like this that normal people and engineers wouldn't come across. So can you explain a bit more about
that? That was my entree into restoration, into dealing with old buildings. I was actually a student at University of Colorado in undergrad, 1986. I was 22 years old.
Wow.
And I was married. I just got married at the time, actually. And, you know, I've always had a job. I was during school. They never gave us work study credits or anything. That was a mistake, I think, by any university. I will acknowledge I learned way more working.
About life in general, right?
Well, just how things, you know, because it's one thing to learn the basics, and that's really important.
Yes.
Absolutely critical for engineers to know how materials work, how structures work. But, you know, to apply that to real world conditions, that's where it's all about. Yeah, that's what it's all about. And so... So I was, what was I doing? I was working in a wood shop, but you know, I walked by the bulletin board up in the civil engineering department at University of Colorado in Boulder, where I grew up. This is my hometown, you know.
Yep.
And again, back before the internet, you know, how do you get a job? You go look at the bulletin board, and it's like, oh, there's a little company. There's like a little three sentences. Oh, we need somebody working the lab. Like, okay, I'll go. Went down there and. Yeah, Atkinson, Noland and Associates. So 1986.
Wow.
And I took a couple of years off to go to grad school, but I've been with this company for, oh my gosh, coming up on 40 years. And it's very rare in today's day and age to stick with any job for that long. But I've been running the company since 1995, and I couldn't imagine anything else. You know, we've got our little existence there, and it's very happy. And once in a while, we make money, and it's just good little job, good little project.
But, having known you and having known your employees and the guys you work with and everything,
they're all the best.
They're the best of the best.
Absolutely the best.
They're the nicest people. They're focused. They're direct. They work as a team, and everybody gets it in the end. And it's a really cool place.
I'm with you, and it's funny, and I'm not divulging any secrets, but you know, when I look to hire an employee. You got to be smart, you know, you got to be intelligent. And most engineers are intelligent. You know, you don't get through engineering school by being a big dummy. Well, I had some buddies in college that got through. It's that C's get degrees. That kind of... But no, you got to be
one of the online ones.
Yeah. But you got to be. Oh, yeah. That guy. You've got to be super smart.
Yes.
You know, and I think you can figure out pretty quick talking to somebody. But what I look for most is. They got to fit in.
Yes.
If you have one employee making waves,
doesn't
get along with other people, it brings down the whole organization. So I've been super lucky for a long time. Everybody is so good.
Cordial. Everybody's beautiful. It's nice. It's a lovely place.
Yeah. And it's great for me to know. And it's good to mention this about the employees. But I tell you, I get a call or an email once a month saying, wow. This guy is fabulous.
Yes.
He did such a great job in this meeting, all this kind of stuff. And it just makes me feel good to see that our, you know, people that are working with us get that kind of recognition.
But one thing as well I noticed, I'm an Englishman and I've been to your office.
Yeah.
Is that where I come from, it's flat. There's nothing. It's neat. All you can do is look, it's like Kansas.
Oh.
And then you get to your place and you walk out of your office door and look up at those mountains.
Oh, well, I got it. I put my office up front for a reason. I got a view of the mountains, a view of the Flatirons above Boulder. It's big rock formations. It's really nice.
And in your office, one thing I've noticed in his office.
What's that?
You have a lot of artifacts.
Just me.
No, wonderful, wonderful Everybody. Artifacts.
They'll get, oh, here's
they've all got a story.
Super cool anchor from this project.
Yes.
And bricks. I got a little brick museum, bricks all over the world.
This was a problem. This was the little piece that broke the camel's back type
that's
of thing.
That's right.
And you've got little bits that all tell a story. And I think that that's one thing with your organization. You've got so much skill set across the board that you can share that knowledge.
It's helpful, too. A client comes in or an architect or even if we're doing an online meeting, it's like, yeah, I want to use these kind of anchors. And they're like, I don't know what that is. So I reach behind me on the shelf. Hold up. Well, here's a anchor. Or here's a grouted anchor. Here's a carbon fiber anchor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was one thing as well, like with me and Mike, when we first met, we used to start talking about cavity wall tie corrosion in the UK and then how it come over here and different things. So it was interesting to talk about different materials and stuff. And that's what Mike does. He assesses a lot of different materials, a lot of different situations.
Yeah, and I kind of got way off tangent, but we were talking about how I got started with NDE, but that was that first job. My company, Atkinson Olin, they had two projects funded by the National Science Foundation in the 80s to look at how do we use modern technology in the 80s to look at historic buildings. So we were using ultrasound, was really the most advanced approach back then. Infrared cameras were only in the military. Radar was not being used outside of archaeology. And so we used, we worked with an Italian University, Politecnico di Milano.
Well,
I got to go over there and work periodically. Like every year I'd do one or two trips and go work with them in their lab. They'd come over here. And so we developed this flat jack testing method.
Right.
Shear test methods for measuring, you know, masonry shear strength and flat jacks for looking at compressive strength and ultrasonics and a lower frequency sonic pulse and rebound hammers, all to look at how do you evaluate an old building? And that expertise was developed as part of that research project, and it continues to this day. And now, you know, I look back, ultrasound, we rarely use that, except on solid stone.
Yes.
There's some really good equipment out for that, by the way.
Uh-huh.
To look at pulse echo, you know, look at the laminations in stones around anchors and things. But yeah, we use radar more than anything else. We use infrared thermography a lot.
Ground penetrating radar.
Yeah, we call it surface penetrating radar because we're not often looking into the ground. Roger. Well, we'll do some ground. We'll like map out cemeteries and things like, you know, grave sites and cemeteries. But I'll bet you, I don't want to say it's every day we're doing radar on buildings, but every week for sure. Absolutely, for sure.
How do you think technology is going to change your organization?
Oh, I know how it's changing because I've talked about it at some conference. Yeah, here's what's up and coming. And there's some really interesting technology. What we're getting into these days is not just, say, doing a radar scan or an infrared scan, and you look at the report and there's 300 pages of infrared images that you can't, you know, you try and make sense of it. But what we're doing, we're taking those images, overlaying it on a three-dimensional model of the building.
Okay.
And I call it, you know, photogrammetry?
Yes.
It's like where you make a model of anything from photographs. Mm-hmm. Well, so we call it infragrammetry. And so we make a model of the building showing, instead of looking at 300 separate images, now you got a model in front of you on the screen, you rotate it and zoom in and out, and you can see exactly how the temperature varies from one part of the building to the next. And we're integrating radar results into that.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows you inside if there's voids or if there's where the metal is. And so we're getting really good at making the information from these high-tech methods understandable to not just architects and other engineers, but clients, you know, building owners, and, you know, so they can understand it and make good decisions.
And we were talking yesterday with one of my new passions over the last year a bit is drones, and we was discussing the other night about micro 3D, how well that will be coming in the future to evaluate builders and paint it in 3D.
We're not far off of that.
Well, the thing is that when we first started doing cavity wall ties and things in England, and we had to do reports and stuff like this, we had to take a Polaroid picture. Now I've got a drone, I can pop up. And the thing is when you're looking up at a building, you don't get the same perspective. But now we're getting different perspectives.
If you're looking straight on, then you see stuff.
Correct. So we're getting different perspectives on buildings, and the technologies are going to get better. But it'd be interesting because as the technologies get better, it's not an extended period of time to get reports. It's going to condense it.
Right.
I wonder how down the line that'll affect the contractor as well, because it goes from there to there to there.
I'm all for it. People are worried about AI. They're worried about, you know, technology taking away our jobs. But crying out loud, as much as I like working in the field, you don't need me standing in front of a building for 4 days to write down cracks. I mean, you can automate that system. You take your drone photographs, your photogrammetry model, put it in an AI system or something that can develop that condition survey for you. And there's always human follow-up. You can't take the humans out of it altogether.
No.
But if it can cut my field time from 4 days to 1 day, or half a day, or an hour, I'm all for it.
Well, like with me, I've started doing downtown tours. A couple of them I've done with the Texas Historical Commission. Then we go for a downtown walking tour. And when I've done that walking tour, afterwards I go back with my drone and fly over some of the situations, and it gives you a whole different perspective. Again, and it's nice for me to say, wow,
right.
So you've done the walking tour, now you can do the flying tour and see it from above.
Right.
Because one of my friends from England said, the thing is with America, he said, there's a problem. I said, what's that? He said, you don't have double-decker buses. I said, how do you work that out? He said, well, look, when we was kids and we used to get on the bus going home back from work, you didn't have to be an engineer to look out the top story of that bus and look at the front of that facade and say, there's a problem with that right there.
Oh, I gotcha.
So, yeah, nobody ever
looks up higher. Yeah.
Nobody ever looks up.
Yeah.
So that's the point I'm making. And as I said, so.
Well, and it's been a great entree to a career, this non-destructive testing. And
yes,
and not just me, but everybody at my company's gotten so good at it. And it takes years.
Yes,
it really does. I mean, because, and I'm not saying concrete, looking at concrete's easy, but it's different.
Yes,
looking at brick and stone is super super difficult.
Certainly is, because of all the materials. Yeah, it's a masonry. I posted now, one yesterday. It's a masonry Jenga.
It is. It's all
masonry Jenga.
And it's funny. I joke with my buddies that are doing concrete work, and you've heard me say this, but you know, if you take a mortar joint and put it in the middle of a concrete wall, it shows up as the biggest flaw in the world. You got to deal with it every 4 inches, you know, or every 3 inches. And so you know, you got to kind of do two things. I think one is relax your expectations a little bit, you know, and understand what you can and can't do. And the second is just get a lot of experience.
Yeah.
And one thing I've learned over the years is I don't trust results from any single method. If I think I'm seeing a void with radar, well, I better follow that up with ultrasonic or infrared thermography or a video scope, drill and look at it, because, you know, it could look like a void, or maybe it's just a difference between stone and mortar, or, you know, who knows what. So multiple methods, you know, using two or three techniques at the same time, that's the key to getting good information.
And attention to detail.
Attention to detail. And a couple other universal truths that I tell all, you know, when I'm out on the job site, first couple times with our new engineers, you know, there's two things, you know, the two key things are, you know, you've got to confirm these methods or these anomalies you think you're seeing inside the wall with multiple methods. That's one thing. We're going to go through three things. The second is, it's not good enough just to look at this building and mark down, oh, here's a crack, there's a spall, here's a stone falling off, here's a brick problem. I want you out there thinking about, how am I going to fix this? Because that'll save you a trip back to site in 2 months when it comes time to design it. So how are we going to fix this crack? Right. What's the difficult thing? And the third thing I tell them is, if you're using these non-destructive techniques, radar and infrared, and you're finding problems that are going to be really expensive to fix, you better darn sure verify it with one of these other methods. So you're scanning with radar, you think, oh, there's a big void in this wall. There's not supposed to be a void. It's supposed to be solid. We're going to have to inject it. We're going to have to rebuild, whatever. It's going to cost a lot of money to fix. So you got to get in there, drill with the bores, you know, drill into that void, look at it with a video scope, say, oh yeah, it is a void, or, oh no, it was something else. You know, who knows what it is in that wall. So yeah, you always got to be thinking about how we're going to fix this building.
That's right. And then I come in on the back end and I'm saying, what kind of anchors do you want to use? How deep do we want to go?
Yeah,
where are we going to go with it? And that's a hard section from it, but it's all a part of what you do, and you evaluate it very well.
That's right.
And you share certainly a lot of knowledge around, and you the jobs.
Well, it is. It's wonderful, and it's been a good career. You know, I'm not totally done with my career yet, but definitely the end is in sight, which is great. And I think we've got a whole generation of people. They love technology. The younger kids, they're 30, you know, the younger engineers, they love technology, and they're at the point where I hate to say they're way better at it than I am anymore. And that's fine.
And the thing
they
is,
do that. I do my thing. They do their thing, and well, we all get along.
I think that the younger generation using all the technology and things like that are certainly going to be able to enhance what you do, and then they're going to learn from there, and it's just going to build on from that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wonderful. No, it's been good, and I'm looking forward to the next 10 or 15 years, and because we've got some great technology coming up and fascinating things that it's going to be great, you know, things that I only wish we could do 30 years ago, and now it's becoming common.
Yes, and we're all starting, and I think because of that there tinternet, we can certainly share a lot more knowledge from around the world and utilize it as a learning curve. I think that's going to be good for us long term.
Well, it's good talking about all of this, you know. Yeah. It's good talking about these things and how you get into it and what some of the important bits are.
How are you mentoring the next
publications? Yeah. What's that?
How are you mentoring the upcoming engineers? I mean, you're talking about
on-site. Oh my gosh. Oh, mentoring, not just my people, but we teach a lot, not just me, everybody. You know, I've already taught like 7 or 8 seminars this year, you know, in the last 4 months. You know, World of Concrete, I teach every year, and I'm down at Georgia Tech University, Georgia Tech. Down at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. I've done some for Minnesota engineers this year, and yeah, we just teach a lot and get people enthused about the technology and start educating how to use it, what's it good for, what's it not good for, and some good publications out. I wrote my second book out was 2019 on assessment and retrofit of masonry. So that all the things we're talking about, you can, for the low price of whatever TMS is charging, masonry.org, that you can buy it there. And it's, you know, 450 some pages with my co-author Ahmad Hamid out of Drexel University.
We'll have to put a link to that because that's a local one for Philly. Yes.
It's like a big brain dump of, you know, here's, you know, 30 plus years of experience and just talking about NDE methods and retrofit approaches and engineering and maintenance and, you know, all these great topics on how to deal with old buildings. So that's how my approach to mentoring is. It's education, publishing, just being there and still working on, I love working on job sites. So that's, I've been doing that a lot more in recent years. I make other people do more of the management stuff. So it's great to get back in the field more.
But the thing is as well, is that you're same as me. If we've got a problem, it's like a red rag to a bull. We've got to figure it out. We want to try and give it its best shot to figure out just why, how, and what happened, and how can we fix it.
Those are the fun ones.
Yeah.
You know, and part of why I like being in this field is, well, it's probably two things. One is, there was a time early on when it's like every single project, I'd never seen anything like it before. And so you're forging new ground. It's not like I could say, oh, I did exactly this last week. No, every job, you got to know your basics. You got to know how buildings work, how materials work, and then apply that to the problems that you're running into. You know, that's great. And it's just fun. You know, I have a good time doing these challenging projects. You know, that's what I'm after anymore, looking for the good challenges and good mental exercise. Mm-hmm. I don't want boredom. I don't want to be bored ever.
No, and I think that...
Yeah, I never am.
And I think that down the line, the things that you are doing is helping educating contractors as well to give a bit of an oversight of how to fix things as well down the line, because it's not easy, as we said, to repair things, but you do offer a lot of guidelines as well, same as the Masonry
Society. That's a good point.
The Masonry Society offers great guidelines.
Yeah.
I know they're very technical, and sometimes as a contractor, they're hard to read, but the bottom line is they were written by really smart, good people, really good, and tried to give you the best information they could.
In another group, before we wrap it up, I've got to mention Association for Preservation Technology, APT. That's the other group I do a lot of work with. They're a wonderful international organization about the technology side of preservation. So not about tax credits, things like that, but how do you deal with old historic construction or really modern buildings as well? And yeah, there's just serious, there's always workshops, there's online webinars that APT is putting on every year. They have a fabulous conference. This year it's in, 2024, it's in Montreal.
Mm.
And so they'll have three or four workshops as part of that conference. And so you teach younger people, you teach other people what you know at these workshops.
And I think not just that as well. I think that there's other organizations from the contractual side of it, but like the IMI and people like that.
Oh, yeah. International Masonry Institute.
Correct.
I did a webinar for them. I told you this, but they're on WebEx. Their platform can handle 1,001 attendees.
Wow.
You know how many I had? It's like 10 minutes before, it was like 400, 500. It's like, wow, that's a lot. That's more than I ever had. But 10 minutes in, I looked at the attendee count, 1,001. We maxed the system out.
Wow.
Yeah, I was on masonry, stabilizing masonry.
Brilliant. Same.
Yeah, and it's all a little bit of NDE, non-destructive, a little bit of, you know, what you're looking for, unstable conditions, a little bit how to fix it. So it was good 1 hour.
And they're gonna help.
1,000 people from all over the world.
And if you can do that, the IMI can look forward to educating contractors and people like that in the future. Yeah. And that's the type of thing that I think America needs.
Yeah, they're great. They're all great.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for spending time talking to us and telling us about this. This has been great.
That was fun.
Yeah, Mike, thank you as always, my friend.
Oh, you bet. Let's go fishing.
Yes.